One sec. Sorry. I haven't got my COVID haircut yet. All right. That seems right, right? So, welcome to my closet. I thought it was sort of ironic to be talking about lessons from the queer community from a location that so many of us are trying to escape. And yet, it is literally the quietest place in my house right now. So, here we are. Welcome. Glad you're here. Now, I came into my queerness in the late 90s, early 2000s, which was after the invent of these life-saving medications that made HIV a chronic but manageable illness. But despite that, I can't understand my queerness, my gayness, without looking through the lens of HIV. Because as a kid, the associations that I had with queerness, with gayness, were that of it being strange, it being wrong, it being hidden, but also that it led to HIV and death. So coming to terms with myself, coming to terms with who I am and who I choose to be, inherently meant coming to terms with these societal stories, a story that told that the ways in which I am are caught in the shadow of death. What's been fascinating to me recently is how there's actually one figure that both plays a central role in the story of HIV/AIDS in this country and the story of COVID-19, and that's Dr. Anthony Fauci. Because as the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, he was at the center of the government's response to both of these pandemics. What many people don't know, especially straight people, is that Anthony Fauci was hated, was vilified. There were op-eds in gay newspapers calling him a murderer because of the way the government was responding to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were dying because of government inaction. And Fauci was the head of an organization that was, you know, supposed to be doing something. And it isn't to say that he wasn't, but the way in which he was going about it was privileging a scientific method, a clinical research over the lives of people. You know, drugs that could possibly save people's lives were restricted into studies before they were given to people that were living with HIV and were dying. You know, when AIDS first appeared in the early 1980s, activists formed organizations like the Gay Men's Health Project, the AIDS Project of Los Angeles, ACT UP, organizations to do what governments, what families, what religious organizations wouldn't do, provide food and shelter and care and support and love to people with HIV/AIDS. The community had to help itself. And there was this big divide, this big disconnect between the community and these institutions. I want to share another part of the interview that we did with Nori, in which she talks about why for her there was this impulse, this impulse to care, like what motivated that for her.
These were my friends, right? I know lesbians who were out at the time but lived in some secluded little community, and AIDS just went right by them like a prey they decided not to go see. So, but it was in my life every day. And so that made a difference. Like, just recently saw this little meme video where a guy is asked, well, you want the economy to survive, so what's the level of acceptable deaths? And he said, oh, anywhere from 70 to 700. So they said, well, let me show you what 70 looks like. And they brought out all these people. And he said, wait, that's my family, right? So then all of a sudden, zero is the number of acceptable deaths. So for a lot of people who didn't have to deal with that, then it didn't matter. And one AIDS activist said it was like fighting a war that only the combatants were aware of, that if you weren't actively in the trenches, you didn't even know there was a war going on. And that's really how it felt.
They were her friends. They weren't some statistic in a medical journal. They weren't some statistic in a newspaper. They were people she knew and loved about. As the Reverend Elizabeth Wynne says, sometimes when we hear the news of the world, it is just that, it's news. And other times when we hear it going on, we realize that it's family, that it hits here. The beautiful thing, though, was that there was a moment in which Dr. Fauci and these activists blurred the lines between this divide. Now, Fauci would later say in an interview, you know, these guys, they dress crazy, they say terrible things, you know, they called him a murderer. But they're mostly from New York, like he was. He said, and let me think about this for a minute. If I had a disease in which the result was that I was going to die no matter what, and the government was telling me, you can't try anything that might work under any circumstance, I'd be ramming the door down too. So he invited them in. He invited them for a conversation. The very activists that were storming the buildings were hosting die-ins at the National Institute of Health. He invited them to a meeting, and he listened. He listened to what they were saying, what they were advocating for. He listened to their anger. I mean, they had fought for that meeting. They had people had spent their last dying days working to try to convince this bureaucracy to take them seriously, and it worked. And they sat down at the table, and they had what Unitarian Universalist historian Dan McCannon, I think, would categorize as a prophetic encounter. Dan writes, when human beings encounter one another deeply in the midst of their struggle for freedom and equality and community, prophetic power can be unleashed. It's a power to denounce all that is evil, but also a power to proclaim the beloved community, that world that we could and must realize. It's a prophetic power that enables people to speak boldly in the face of those that would bludgeon them down. It empowers them to tell new stories, build new communities, to forge a new future. And it's an encounter that happens person to person. It's an encounter that moves us from a distance to up close, from disconnected to interconnected, from something that might be news to something that is family. As a result of this meeting, parallel track, this idea that the AIDS activists had been trying to advocate for years, that as soon as a drug is safe enough for a clinical trial, that it should be made available for those who may benefit from it, even if there's no evidence of it. That was the severity of the issue. You know, the same parallel track advocacy has fundamentally changed how the FDA and other organizations go about clinical trials as they deal with infectious disease. The same shifts that are currently now being used, experimental treatments for COVID-19 are being rolled out. That's a legacy of ACT UP, of the activism of this time. What our ancestors fight for sets the stage of the possible today. That prophetic encounter was risky. It was risky because it asked both groups, that prophetic encounter was risky because it asked both groups to potentially be changed by it and to enter into partnership. Now, it wasn't an easy partnership. It didn't always go well, and it wasn't perfect. I mean, it wasn't just rainbows and unicorns after that, but there was a shift. People who were most affected by HIV/AIDS policy were put on the committees that were making the decisions. Nothing about us without us became the mantra. Now, the series we're in right now is exploring collective resilience. Collective resilience means all, not some. Collective resilience takes a commitment to a wider circle. Now, we know now that COVID-19 is running along the familiar fault lines of our society, of race, of poverty, of access to healthcare. It is exacerbating those inequalities, and the people who are dying, the essential workers of our society, are being asked to sacrifice of themselves in this moment, living even more so under the shadow of death that has fallen upon them for generations as they felt the brunt of our toxic systems. Now, many of us right now are in our little bubbles, especially those of us who are white, who are middle class. We're distancing. We're distancing from each other. We're distancing from touch, from even going and touching things that other people have touched, because we don't want to get sick. We don't want to get other people sick. And yet, these bubbles are maintained by privilege. Social distancing isn't a far cry from social segregation when you think about what is necessary to maintain it. And so the policies that we are making, the choices that we are making, as states declare they're open for business, the question is, who is going to take the brunt of that? what's going to be the people that have been taking the brunt of it for generations? Again, it's going to be the people in the meatpacking plants that have been forced back, even though infections are running wild amongst their populations. It's going to be people who are incarcerated, people living in long-term care facilities. It's going to be these people who are going to face the brunt of this new reality. Collective resilience takes commitment. It takes a commitment to encountering the other, to truly being willing to be transformed by it, to risk changing our minds. It means listening to those who are on the front lines, who are most impacted, so that the prophetic call can be realized. It asks us to distance ourselves not from truth or each other's stories, but to act up and fight for the world that we dream about. Because here's the truth. We are gathered here in the mystery of what will come next in the hours and the days and the years to come. We are all in this. And the question will be, will we fight this off as it is, if it is a disease of our collective body, or will we try to deal with the disease as if it is truly to be contained in someone else's? The prophetic call of our ancestors sets the tale of the possible that says that through our encounter with one another, through being open to the truths that demand us to listen to those most impacted, may we truly know the struggle and realize the power of our collective being. That as the Reverend Teresa Sota says, all of us need all of us to survive. That it takes commitment, prophetic commitment, in each day and each moment. Amen. Bless you.
Gathered here in the mystery of the hour.